那张出来了。I am a historian, and I do write science fiction novels. I write rather a lot of science fiction novels, and I'm not lecturing at Max Weber's Academy. Really, Max Weber's University, what a privilege. People often ask science fiction writers where we get our ideas. I like to borrow ideas from industrial designers. Very fruitful for me. I've been doing that for years. I've come to know a lot of people in the profession. They become friends of mine. I've even been known to lecture on the subject. And this year, there was a breakthrough. The faculty of a design school asked me to teach design. I'm actually becoming an academic this year. It's a miracle. During the year 2005, I'll be a design professor at the Art Center College of Design in California. And I move there next month. And my official title is Provocateur in Residence. That's my official title. After 20 years of writing novels, I have a real job, ladies and gentlemen. I even have a salary. Not many novelists become design teachers. I'm not a designer, although I did design this lamp. This is the only object I have ever designed in my very brief design career. It goes into production this month. It's French. I'm hoping this eccentricity of mine won't last too long. I'm only a design professor for a couple of semesters. Basically, I see it as a good chance to repay the world of design for the many, many ideas that I stole from designers. So I have been working on some design concepts of my own, hoping to bring something to the party. And of course, since I'm a science fiction writer, they're rather fantastic and futuristic ideas. Tonight, I plan to tell you about those. Oh, I'm not an industrial designer. I don't make things. At least I don't make many things. And when I do make them, I try to stop. But I've always been very interested in the future of technical infrastructure. And I found that for my own purposes, I need to study objects. I need to study objects with a designer's intensity. I don't often make things. But I do want to understand what kind of new things might be made in the future. Now, I see six major trends at work today. Now, I've been aware of all of these technical trends for some time. But recently, it occurred to me that these six trends seem to be converging. They're becoming integral parts of a larger general concept. They're like six sides of a black box. And inside that box is the Christmas surprise, the thing that is to come. These six trends are, number one, interactive chips that can label objects with unique identities. Number two, local and global positioning systems. It can determine the locations of objects in space and time. And number three, powerful search engines. Number four, 3D virtual design of objects, virtual models of objects. Number five, rapid prototyping production of objects, computer fabrication of objects. And the last, cradle-to-cradle recycling. Zero emissions manufacturing, design for disassembly, a new kind of death for objects. Now, the key concept in all this is that very first part, the identity. this identity that enables the whole transformation. My suspicion, my theory, is that we're about to give identity to almost everything we make. And once we name things, then we can track them through their lifetime. And if we can track them from cradle to cradle, cradle to grave, then we can subject them to manipulation much more sophisticated than anything we ever managed before. Eventually, we'll learn to think about physical objects in a new way, in a way that was previously unthinkable. We will have a new class of objects that have new properties and new behaviors. And I call these objects spines. A spine is an object that can be precisely tracked through space and time. A spine is a protagonist. It has its own history. It has a trajectory. It creates an archive of data as it passes through our hand. It's a rather German concept, this spine. This kind of precision, this thoroughness of detail. There might be a long German word for this concept, but it's much better than spine. But my suspicion is that the future will see, it will create billions of small histories for billions of objects. And eventually we will come to understand that the recorded histories of objects are more important than objects. They're more useful than objects. They're even more profitable the objects themselves. The data is what will really matter. The object is a hard copy. Well, that's a bold thesis. Science fiction writers rather like shocking ideas. But I want to explain to you how and why this might come to pass in real life. So let's talk about something that's familiar to everybody. Barcodes on objects. Here we've got one. Barcodes. They're identities for objects. That is their purpose. If you come through this city block in München, searching for barcodes on objects, you will find tens of thousands of barcodes. This object here, my telephone, it's got three barcodes on it all by itself. I've got three barcodes in my front pocket. They're too common for us to notice. We're living in an ocean of barcodes. That's not remarkable. We don't notice that. It's beneath our notice. But 30 years ago, there were no barcodes. Not even one. They did not exist at all. Now these barcodes were placed there deliberately. A global bureaucracy exists. And their purpose is to attach identities to objects, barcodes. And that is a non-profit, non-governmental, global organization known as the EAN International. And along with its American twin, which is the Uniform Code Council, that plans and manages a global identity regime for objects. And that is known as the EAN UCC Global System. They had some Spanish iteration there. Now, this barcode revolution started in 1975, and it was a revolution that was a huge success. By adding identity to objects, barcodes enabled very accurate inventories. Barcodes automated reordering. Barcodes improved market analysis. Barcodes made products flow more quickly through retail stores. They made real estate more valuable. Barcodes also caused a big reduction in human errors in the supply chain and in the cash register. So it was good for business. And it meant a whole lot of money to a lot of people. So that revolution happened, whether we noticed it or not. On this day, barcodes were scanned somewhere on this planet 5 billion times. However, paper paper barcodes are obsolete. They work well now, but they're too slow and too limited for the future's purposes. This system of black and white bars is under threat from the new and improved electronic product code. And why is that? Well, barcodes are made of paper. Electronic codes are electronic. That's the difference. Now, barcodes really are nothing more than numbers on paper, 8 to 14 digits. You can see a relic barcode at the bottom of the electronic chip. And these codes can only speak about two things. The first numbers on the barcode are the ID number for the company that made the object. And the other numbers are the ID number that tells what kind of object that is. So, for instance, Brown the coffee maker, Brown the company, coffee maker the object, Brown coffee maker. That's all that a barcode can say. Now, the very last number in a barcode is a security number, the checksum number. And that last number is there to try and make sure that some accident, mishap, criminal or incompetent hasn't messed up the other bars and numbers. Because the barcode system is not perfect. It will never be perfected. It will be obsolete long before it's ever fully developed. And it is vulnerable to fraud and decay and error and abuse, just like all inventory systems. The electronic system we're about to get will be 100 times more vulnerable to those things than paper codes. But it will be 1,000 times more effective. The electronic product code is the foundation for the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things. Now, in a paper barcode, there's no such thing as an individual object. All objects have to be parts of a class of objects. That is, a particular model of shoe by the Nike shoe company. That barcode is not a serial number for each individual shoe. Because all Nike shoes of a certain model have to share the same barcode number. That obviously limits their usefulness. That scheme isn't finely detailed. It's too general. And we're far, far better at scanning and storing numbers now than we were back in 1975. So why are we still stuck with those glued-on strips of barcode paper? Well, we're not stuck. We are moving. That's the news. Now, a new and improved barcode would obviously import and store much more identity on objects. They would name and number every single item in fine, meticulous detail. It would also announce its identity more loudly and under a wider set of circumstances to a wider set of scanning devices in much more sophisticated ways. Well, how could a mere code do such a thing? Well, it does it with a little computer and a little radio. How little? How little? Quite little. Littler than that? Yes. Very little. I'm going to try that again. That is a tag that could be on the back of your neck, in your shirt. How small? About that small. And how cheap? About 5 cents. Can you really make a computer with a radio for 5 cents? 20 tiny computers and tiny radios for 1 euro? Is that possible? Not now, no. Now they cost about 50 cents. But in 5 years, yeah, they'll be that cheap. They'll almost certainly be that cheap. this is a new model, electronic identity for objects, RFID, radio frequency identity. RFID is busily replacing barcodes. The Pentagon uses them. Walmart uses them. They're also in use in Germany, where a lot of people don't like them. Send Gillette a message, don't buy products with tracking devices. Small enough to fit into a razor, cheap enough to track a razor. Hands off privacy. Stop RFID. You'll see that these anti-RFID campaigners are cleverly using an RFID chip as their stop sign logo. Kind of nice graphic design moment there. There's an icon if I ever saw one. Seems to be trying to stop RFID development in its tracks. It's going to freeze the technology before it gets any traction on the ice. He's an early disadopter, our snowman. There is a culture war over RFIDs. That's an obscure one, but it will get louder. Not because RFIDs are inherently a bad technology, but because they are important enough and powerful enough to be properly controversial. This is a very powerful technology, which is highly subject to abuse. To have a name, to have an identity, is to be robbed of anonymity. If we give every object a name, then every object has a history. Every object we own, or pass, or see, has a dossier. And who owns the dossier? Who compiles the dossier? Who can access it, and under what circumstances? These aren't technical questions. These are political questions. Now, some activists call them spy chips. Rather than RFIDs, they are spy chips. And why do they call them that? Because they are chips that can spy. That's one of their capacities. These are chips that can build dossiers. And if you think that dossiers are bad, then chips must be inherently bad. Here's a prisoner. An RFID in a band around his wrist. This man can't go through doors without setting off alarms. He has become a trackable object. Prisoners have serial numbers. They have product codes. But this man has a serial number with a computer and a radio. This man may be a criminal, or he may simply be someone that the authorities don't like. He might even be someone whom terrorists don't like. He might be a captured hostage, for instance. A hostage who can't escape, yet has no visible walls around him. Because he's a man forced to carry a spy chip against his will. And that makes him a prisoner just as much as iron bars can. Here the prisoner is showing himself to a wall scanner. Here's a patient in a hospital with a very similar tag. Identical technology, different purpose. This tag could be saving his life. Hospitals are large, complex bureaucracies. They make a lot of inventory mistakes in hospitals. If you're given the wrong medicine through a clerical oversight, you can die of that. Sometimes babies get misplaced in hospitals. Sometimes patients receive the wrong operation. This patient might be unconscious and unable to tell his own name. He can't supply his identity. But a doctor might scan that chip with that RFID wand and learn his medical history in seconds. So that chip might very well save this man's life. You can have an RFID in your trousers. ants in your pants. Maybe you know it's hiding there in your trousers. Or maybe you don't. Do you have a striped barcode anywhere in your pants? Did you ever search through your pants to see if there were a barcode in there somewhere? Does that matter? What if it's a barcode that can announce itself to scanning machines 10 meters around? Today's outfits are primitive and simple because this technology is very young. Tomorrow, we'll see a host of specialized, sophisticated outfits. Many purposes, many uses. The first generation of outfits barely work. An outfit can't send out radio by itself. But if you fire a radio beam at it, it can bounce a radio signal back to you with the identity embedded in that reflected beam. That's what people are doing with these readers and scanners, these ARFID wands. Now that's a passive ARFID. Those already exist in large numbers. Passive ARFIDs are fairly cheap and easy to make. Active ARFIDs are more futuristic because active ARFIDs would have their own power supply. That would allow them to do a great many useful and interesting and possibly sinister things. But since power supplies, batteries, fuel cells are large and costly and short-lived and difficult to replace, the active ARFID is still speculative. It's a laboratory curiosity. But the passive ARFID, which is so cheap and simple, is a booming industry. There are tens of thousands. There will be millions. Someday there will be billions. They will cost 5 cents or less. A technology that costs 5 cents is too cheap not to exploit. So, ARFIDs are tiny computers with tiny radios. It follows that one can build a new, comprehensive, electronic identity system with ARFIDs. The ARFIDs antenna and chip get built into a weatherproofed and durable ID tag, which is sealed and then glued or attached or built in to objects. And an ARFID wand reads radio energy into the ARFIDs and then reads their unique codes as they bounce back out. And this data from this ARFID wand gets radioed out, up or down the data stream, to a host computer somewhere, which is running ARFID manipulation software, an inventory system. These ARFIDs can get counted, located, timed, sold, restocked, checked out, shipped, deployed, exploited, destroyed, depending on the intentions of the users and the capacity of the system. Someday, we will be swimming in this. And after that day, we will come to understand that the tracking system is more important than the objects that it tracks. Because the object is inert. It merely sits there. The system is interactive. And it is linked to the life of that object. From conception to recycling, from birth to death. Amazon.com is not a warehouse full of books. The books are not the source of Amazon's wealth. Amazon is a comprehensive system that sells books and also clothes, electronics, gardening tools. You can buy things on Amazon before those things are made. You can buy antiques on Amazon, and they are no longer made. Well, that was the first of my six friends, and it's the most important one. Identity. Radio frequency identity. Now let's talk about that second trend. Locating systems. locative technologies. Now, paper barcodes have to be scanned with a barcode reader. Arthrids behave like bats. They have radar. They can be heard in total darkness. You can hear them while they move. You can beam radio across vast numbers of them all at once in massive flocks of arthrids. And machines can hear them and keep track of them. You don't need humans to see and count arthrids. An arthrid management system can be automated. It will inventory every arthrid in its radio range and do that as often as human beings. Now, passive arthrids have a short range, less than 10 meters, because arthrids are little radio stations, tiny radio stations. And as you move farther away from them, well, the coverage weakens and the signal breaks up. And furthermore, metal, plumbing, metal appliances, and liquid, a whole wide variety of everyday clutter, will reflect radio beams in the arthrid wavelengths. So that means that most real-world environments are full of radio shadows, where arthrids become invisible to scan. Now, 10 meters may seem like a very short range, not very useful. But imagine if arthrids had a long range, say a kilometer. Then thieves could build an arthrid reader inside of a van. And those thieves with that reader could simply drive through the streets of Moochie looking for wealthy people with a lot of arthrid tag goods. Thieves could simply stand outside the rich person's house, beaming some radio in, and every object in the house would tell the thieves what it was. This practice is known as skimming. Skimming is when you steal data surreptitiously from an arthrid. Skimming is a way to hack the Internet of Things. There will be many ways to hack the Internet of Things. So, 10 meters. If you want to watch your arthrids all the time, you would have to have an arthrid reader every 10 meters. But this is actually good. Because if you have an arthrid reader every 10 meters, you have a grid. You have a grid of monitors. And once you have a grid, it's very easy to locate things within the grid. Whenever an object moves in one monitor and appears on the other monitor, that can be calculated and recorded. The signals can be triangulated, located very accurately. And these monitors can communicate information about the arthrids to one another. So they become the bosses and the guards and the coordinators of the flocks of arthrids. They can track where the arthrids are, what they are, their identity. And since they can also watch them moving through the grid, moving through space and time, they can track what the arthrids are doing. Not just today, here and now, they can archive that behavior over years. Everything that once had a barcode now has a recordable history. And you can search that history. You can data mine it. Now add these monitors into the mix, these active hubs for arthrid data, these computers, relayers, linked to a global network. Then you have an Internet of Things. And given an Internet for Things, you can read your arthrids anywhere you have Internet access. Via the net, via cell phone, via satellite, the sky is the limit. But the sky is not the limit, because for an Internet of Things, the sky is the metric. Global positioning satellites provide a splendid source of accurate measurement for a space-time spiraling world. There's local positioning on the ground, global positioning in the sky. Ubiquity. America has a GPS system. Europe is trying hard to build one. Trend number three, search engines. Google Local. Faithful. What is the most useful service on the internet? It is Google, which is a search engine. Along with the Internet of Things, you have a search engine for physical objects. And what good is that? Well, you don't have to remember where you put things anymore. You don't have to use your brain. You simply ask a voice recognition system with a search interface, "Where are my shoes?" Your shoes are under your bed. That's simple. You may not think that's a very useful service now, but wait until you are 75 years old. In this century, there will be more old people with more loose objects than ever before. Now, there are some situations where search engines for objects could be a matter of immediate life and death. Emergency zones, natural disaster rescue, battlefields. The searching systems might start in those environments, but they wouldn't stop there. Google Local. This is a system already in place, which is meant to help you search out, through Google, things which are closest to you. It's a search engine for local proximity. Trend number four, virtual design. We can track objects. We can give them identities. We can search for them. Why are we waiting for them to exist before we learn about them? Why don't we work with the original electronic plans of the object? If we do that, we don't have to worry about making objects or storing objects until we decide that we want one. The object does not come to exist physically until we express a desire to see it produced. Simple, convenient, electronic. And yes, you can't make road graders on these devices. Now, sometimes I really do want an object. I want the thing, claw thing. I need the entity itself. I have to have it there at hand. But at many other times, many crucial occasions in my relationship with an object, I'm much better served with a digital representation of the object. Suppose, for instance, that I'm trying to create a new kind of object, to shape a new kind of thing. I don't want to be burdened with the physical weight of the old object. I want a virtual model of the new object. I want a weightless, conceptual, interactive model that I can rotate inside a screen using 3D design software. You see, now I'm not troubled by its stubborn materiality. It's a real machine with real machine parts. It's not a toy. But I'm much freer to radically alter its form because I can see left, right, front, back, top, bottom. There's no gravity. There's no friction. There's no raw material needed to make any physical models. I'm spared all those old necessities of foam board and modeling clay, chicken wire frames, plaster. I can change these plans as many times as I want. I can make as many copies of these plans as I want. I can restore the changes. I can save the changes. I can erase the changes. I can export the changes. Because it's only data. It's weightless and immaterial and manipulable. And I can research vital information about my activity without lifting my hands from the keyboard or ever taking my eyes from the screen. And I can show this work to scattered co-workers all over the planet at very little cost. I can offshore it to India. I can email it to China. I can get it back into the day. I've got an object processor. An object processor. And I'm no more likely to return to the older methods than authors are likely to return to paper and typewriters. Now, what could possibly be next? Well, I still have to make physical objects from my plans. So why not cut to the chase? Let's simply print the object. We'll make an object of the plan in one simple, immediate step. And this is trend number 5. I'll use a 3D printer, a rapid prototype, a fabricator. After a while, once I'm used to the new reality, I don't even think of my virtual model as a model anymore, because my model has become the crucial part of the creative effort. The physical object itself has become merely industrial output. The model is the manager's command and control platform for the fate of the object. The object itself is merely hard copy. In a spine world, the model is the entity. It is the entity, and everyone knows that. So let's imagine that it's 30 years from now. What happens when you meet a spine? Well, here's the scenario. You first encounter your spine while searching on a website for something you desire. And you see it as a virtual image, like the image of a book that you see on Amazon. Now this image is likely a glamorous publicity photo, basically an advertisement. But it's also linked to the genuine three-dimensional computer design engineering specifications of the object. The engineering tolerances, the material specs, and so forth. You can dig down in as far as you might care to go. And until you express your desire for this object, it does not exist. You create a spine by buying it with electronic credit, which is to say, you legally guarantee that you want it to exist. It therefore comes to be. In a rapid single-step manufacturing process from a fabricator. And as it's built, the object is given a unique ID code. Now after the purchase, manufacture, and delivery of your identified and coded spine, a lead is established in customer relations management software, which involves you into the further development of this object. And that link, at a minimum, includes the full list of the spine's ingredients, which would be basically the object's material and energy flows, its history of design, its history of ownership, geographical tracking hardware and software to establish its position in space and time, various handy recipes for post-purchase customization of your spine, a public site for interaction and exchange of opinion about your spine, live views of the production process, sell it to somebody else. And the spine is able to update itself at your spine management database and to inform you of required service calls or safety warnings with appropriate links to service centers and governmental bureaus. And then step six, at the end of its product lifespan, the spine is deactivated. Its identity is removed. It is removed from your presence by specialists. It is entirely disassembled, and its components are folded back into the manufacturing stream. It is smart garbage. And the data that it generated while it existed and before remains available for historical analysis by a wide variety of interested parties. And that variety and those parties and their level of interest in the doing of your object is what you consider to be a genuinely crucial interest. Because the spine is a set of relationships, first and always, and an object now and then. But I haven't yet said what a spine really is, or how. Let's imagine my spine as a shoe. It doesn't seem like a very complicated object. Normally, people buy a pair of shoes. But in the spine world, people might very well simply buy one shoe. Why? Because every shoe is individual and made on demand. And if one shoe got damaged, my dog ate my left shoe, let's say, I have the record of my shoe and all its component and product specifications. I'll just ask for an upgrade, a right shoe. What is a shoe? What is an object, really? Are they commodities or are they processes? In a spine world, a shoe is understood as a unique object with a unique history. Before I asked for that shoe, it didn't exist. Then there was a conjugation. There was a gathering together of material and energy flows. No shoe lasts forever. Every product has a mortal lifetime. And when it's done, I will see to it that it is disposed of properly, folded back in the production stream. Once my shoe is a spine, once it is fully trackable from beginning to end, then I come to understand it differently. It is not a commodity, but an aspect of an ongoing post-industrial process. A shoe is a pause in time. It is a stall. It was a very momentary entity. It was here, it was gone, it left nothing. It evanesced, but it did not live in vain because it left its data. It left us history. Because of that shoe, I'm richer in history now. Oil runs out, and coal runs out, and the sloppy industrial habits of pollution and short-term thinking will always catch up with me as the clock continues to tick. It's mortal. And I who held it immortal, and we're all mortal, and our devices are mortal. Time, however, does not stop. History is our one inexhaustible resource. My society is getting wealthier, more capable, better informed by watching the clock tick, while watching, recording, comprehending. That's my story tonight. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Thanks for your attention.